Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you're staying healthy. Today's readings are from the Good Old Days, March issue. This first story is entitled Downtown with Granny. The trips usually went well unless she got bored. This was sent in by Phyllis Taylor. Growing up in Grand Prairie, Texas in the early 1950s was easy and fun for me. Most weekends were spent with my paternal grandparents. My dad's biological father had been killed when Daddy was 18 months old. Papa Ford stepped in to fill the gap, so he was always in my life. On Friday nights, I learned at a very young age to play church. This consisted of singing a few hymns and collecting the offering, always taken by me, of course, in an old Folgers coffee can. My haul was usually a quarter, sometimes more. I was quite the dynamic hymn singer, and my grandparents were an appreciative congregation. My quarter was tied up in a handkerchief, so I wouldn't lose it. The next morning, my grandmother would wake me up by banging pot lids and shuffling her feet in what seemed to be tap dance shoes, but were really house shoes called mules. After breakfast, dishes were done. Then Granny got out the dust mop and mopped the wooden floors, being careful to get the dust bunnies that bred under the bed. It seemed like agony having to wait for all the housework to get done. Then she would pile up her long black hair on her head in a bun. My excitement began to grow, as this was the final step before we piled into the old Ford so Papa Ford could take us to downtown Grand Prairie. At that time, our little city was booming and downtown was always busy, but on Saturday even more so. We had two variety stores, which were called dime stores, though some things could cost as much as two whole dollars, and some things could cost a nickel. I took my hard-earned church offering money and usually bought the latest comic book. If I had saved extra money, sometimes I bought my dad a small bag of peanut clusters, his favorite candy. I would linger at the candy counter, looking at all the choices, but I never deviated from the peanut clusters. Once in a while, I had to buy myself a dime's worth of candy corn, too. I would eat the orange, yellow, and white in sections to make it last longer. If I put a lot of it in my mouth at once, it became gluey and stuck to the roof of my mouth. When I'd made my purchases, my grandmother would go to JCPenney's and look at the dresses. They started at $2.98 and went all the way up to about $5.98. I would play in front of the three-way mirror while she shopped. I got tired of waiting once when I was 5 years old, and I told her I was going to walk home. Never thinking I would, she said, "Go ahead." So I did. My dad was calm when he saw his 5-year-old daughter walk up the sidewalk. All he said was, "Where's Granny?" "She told me I could come home," I answered. He didn't say anything else, just, "Come here and let me get the hair out of your eyes." When Granny looked for me after she finished looking at the dresses, she panicked and called my mother, who was a sales clerk at a small shop down the street from Penny's. Mother came home and my grandmother came home, both crying. There I was in the front yard, playing, with my hair pulled back in a ponytail, held with the wire band from the Grand Prairie banner, thanks to my dad. As I said, it was a fun and easy time, at least for me. This was Downtown with Granny by Phyllis Taylor. This next story is entitled Where's Mark? By now, the question sounded dreadfully familiar. This was sent in by Annette Goggin, who was Mark's sister. My dad was a pastor for 40 years in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. He was the kind of pastor who called on the church people, going to their homes to offer encouragement and prayer, and visited the sick in the hospitals. Sometimes he would take one of us kids along to give my mother a break. At the time of this story, I had not yet been born, and my sister Margaret was an infant. That meant my brother Mark was the only candidate old enough to tag along. Mark was obedient and mature for five, and the world seems to have been a safer place in 1960. Ironically, the combination of those characteristics contributed to an unfortunate event. One of the flock was a patient at Mercy Catholic Hospital, and my dad wanted to pay a visit. He took Mark along. Daddy knew the visit would be short, and a hospital room is no place for a five-year-old, so he explained to Mark that he could sit in the waiting room in the front lobby. Mark had brought some toys and coloring books, so he was pleased with the plan. This was a routine they had done before, and Mark knew that he could go to the nun who watched over the lobby if he needed anything. My dad made his visit, said a prayer, and left. But he didn't just leave the room, he left the hospital. As he strode through the waiting room and out the door, his mind must have been full of the many things he needed to remember. His drive across the city was pleasant enough, but when Daddy walked in the door at home, his welcome was short-lived. It didn't take my mother long to notice someone was missing. "Where's Mark?" she gasped. Daddy's trip back to the hospital wasn't nearly as pleasant as his drive home had been. He found Mark in the waiting room in the care of a nun. He had played with his toys and colored for a really long time, but he'd finally begun to whimper a few minutes before my dad got back to the hospital. Mark hadn't gone into a full-blown cry, but he sure was glad to see a familiar face. Daddy didn't make that mistake again. Miscommunication gets the blame for the second verse of this same song. Mark was 8 years old this time. Margaret was four. I was a newborn. The Sunday night church service had ended, and Mother was eager to get Margaret and me to bed. The parsonage was only a couple of blocks from the church, so my mom asked one of the church folk if they would give the three of us a ride. She told my dad she was going on home, and off he went. Daddy saw Mother leave the building with me and Margaret. Mark usually played tag with the other boys in the summer twilight after the evening service, so my dad assumed that my mom had rounded him up as she left. She, on the other hand, assumed he would bring Mark home. An important detail in this snafu was that Mark wasn't playing in the churchyard at all. He had fallen asleep during the service and had eventually toppled over, so he was half sitting, half lying on his side in the pew. My dad visited with people until the last lingerers had gone. Then he scanned the sanctuary before he turned out the lights, locked the church doors in the growing darkness, and went home. As soon as he walked in the door, he was greeted with a succinct question he had heard before. "Where's Mark?" When my dad got back to the church, Mark was still in dreamland, so he suffered no ill effect from his brief abandonment. My mom and dad told him what had happened, and Mark learned a lesson that has stuck with him for 50-some years. I'd bet my next tithe check that he has not fallen asleep in church since that time. This was Where's Mark by Annette Goggin. This next story is entitled New Beginnings. Even the kids pitched in. This was written by Kathleen Fessler. Every spring, we labored over spring cleaning. In long past years, children were part of that workforce. My sister and I were in grade school, old enough to help. It was in the 1940s, and we were just coming out of the Depression years. Our town, Skokie, Illinois, was a small town then and was formerly called Niles Center. There were not many labor-saving appliances back then. Most all the cleaning was done with our own hands. We called the spring cleaning deep cleaning. Every area of the house had to be cleaned. All the floors were scrubbed. Carpets were taken out to the clothesline and beaten with a wire rug beater. We took turns beating the rugs. Clouds of dust filled the air. Every window was washed, and pictures were taken off the walls, which were then washed or dusted. All curtains needed washing and ironing. Mom pinned some of the curtains onto a big wooden frame, which stretched the material as it dried, so that the curtains needed no ironing. The wallpaper was cleaned with a clay-like material that was spongy, like today's Silly Putty. As we sponged it down the wallpaper, any dust adhered to it. It was hard work, but washing down the painted walls was more of a challenge. Most homes were heated with coal furnaces in those days, and the coal dust stuck to the walls. Shelves were wiped clean and useless items thrown into the trash. Cobwebs were also a nuisance and had to be removed. We often used vinegar and water as our cleaning agent. It was cheaper than soap and did a good job. We cleaned windows with dry, bunched-up newspaper. It worked beautifully. Winter storm windows, with their little slat on the bottom for fresh air, were taken down and replaced with screens. It was wonderful to open windows and let the fresh air come through the house. What a joy it was to see the back porch screens go up. So many happy summer evenings were spent on that porch. In those days, the family gathered on the porch after supper to enjoy the cool evening. We didn't have television to keep us indoors. The kitchen floor was washed and waxed. We put on old socks to slide around on the waxed floor until it shone. That was the fun part of spring cleaning. Pantry shelves were cleaned and supplies added. The icebox was cleaned with baking soda, and porcelain sinks and bathtubs were scrubbed clean with kitchen cleanser. Even the fruit cellar was cleaned. Jars that had lost their seal were discarded. Inventory of remaining canning was completed, and room was made for the coming summer's produce. There was always a feeling of new beginnings after spring cleaning, a feeling of satisfaction. Even as a child, I took pride in contributing to our yearly ritual. This was New Beginnings by Kathleen Fessler. And boy, did this story make me feel guilty. I have not done that kind of spring cleaning in a long time. This next story comes from the section entitled Good Old Days on Wheels. The story is entitled Cooped Up and Let Loose. It was time to get out and play, thanks to their dad's resourcefulness. This was sent in by Mabel Grogan. Springtime is a wonderful time, especially to children who've been kept in a kitchen the entire stretch of winter months. Unfortunately, it was 1934, in the middle of the Depression. When you don't have a job and there's barely enough money to pay for one utility, my parents chose to pay for electricity. That way the neighbors would not know we were so poor and that we children had electricity to do our homework and read books. But it was springtime now, and our little legs wanted to get up and run around the yard. My big brother Paul and my brother Ned soon would have a 3-month vacation from school. I was the first girl, Mabel was my name, and I hoped to be going to school the next semester. Our neighbors often complained that Dad kept bringing junk home. but that did not deter my dad. As he took his bakery products out into the Illinois farmland, he would often spy a piece of wood or some other unwanted thing and bring it home. He might burn the wood to make the house warm for a while, or he might make it into something for us kids to play with. That spring, he made a ladder, and the boys played like the back porch was on fire and they had to save me. They taught me how to climb up and down the ladder. We had so much fun. Then Dad made a seesaw out of some other wood he'd picked up. Paul rode on one side, and Ned and I had to go together on the other side to balance it out. But the best thing Dad brought home was a steering wheel. It wasn't long before a Jeep appeared. Paul decided he was the only one who was allowed to drive it, since he was the oldest. I think he drew up his own driver's license. He loaded us up, and we were ready to go. Paul went to the front of the car and made a cranking noise, do-di-a-di-um, several times. Then Ned pulled out the make-believe choke, and Paul made a few more do-di-a-di-ums. Finally, it sounded like the engine had started. Then Paul's voice went, a-wing, 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 and he jumped inside to grab the steering wheel. We were off. The motor hummed. That was an easy imitation for either boy. I can still hear these sounds today. Oh, how far we went in that car. Paul drove us all over the city. We went to the store and pretended to get food. Sometimes we got stuck in the mud, and Ned and I had to push. Sometimes Paul had to cuss out other drivers for getting in our way. I can't tell you how many cities, places, and towns we drove to all in our backyard. Everyone should have a father like ours, who provided opportunities to use our imaginations when times were tough. This was Cooped Up and Let Loose by Mabel Grogan. You do realize that they were not really driving around town. It was just make-believe. There's a picture that came with this article that shows the kids there sitting in a kind of a wooden box with a big round wooden wheel and the steering wheel. So they're pretending to drive. Adorable. This next story is entitled Cowgirl Dreams. When their parents didn't cooperate, the kids took evasive action. This was sent in by Kathy Bailey. In 1959, my father, who worked for an oil company, was transferred to Casper, Wyoming. We checked in to the Gladstone Hotel in downtown Casper. Daddy called it the Happy Rocks Hotel, while my parents looked for a house. Housing was hard to come by. Casper was in an oil boom at the time, but eventually they did find a house to buy. It was a brand new tract house on top of Dead Horse Hill. The need for new housing was so intense that there had been no pretense at aesthetics. The land had been completely stripped and the small houses put up quickly on small lots. Other than a small lawn Daddy planted in our front yard, we were surrounded by dirt. My sister Lee was in junior high and I was in the second grade. My school was at the bottom of Dead Horse Hill, only a few blocks from home. I was the proverbial new kid at school as we arrived in the middle of the school year, but I don't remember it being a huge problem. There were a lot of new kids in a boom town, and I was used to being teased for having red hair anyway. We quickly became friends with the other kids on our street. Diane Murphy lived next door. She was a little younger than I was, and her father also worked for the oil company and carpooled with Daddy. Diane and I were both horse crazy, and one day a couple of Lee's friends rode over on their horses, a buckskin and a black and white pinto. We got to sit in the saddle on the buckskin, whose name was Maverick, and we were unbelievably envious of these two elegant cowgirls. Both Diane and I begged our parents to buy us our own horses. My mother tried to explain to me that because we moved often, we would never be able to take a horse with us. That made no sense to my 7-year-old self. Didn't we always have a garage? There was plenty of room for a horse and a garage. I spent the next week dreaming of the perfect horse, a beautiful Palomino, or maybe a black and white Pinto with a shiny brown leather saddle where I would sit, suddenly transformed into an elegant teenager in blue jeans and cowboy boots, with a long, soft chiffon scarf tied around my hair and hanging down my back. It wasn't too long before I hatched the perfect plan. Diane and I would run away from home and go hide with one of the cowgirls, who we guessed lived near Casper Mountain because I had seen ranches in that area. I had no doubt at all that either of them would welcome us with open arms when they knew the reason for our running away. That our parents were too mean to buy horses for us. We would live in the cave on their property. It was a ranch by the mountain, so of course there would be a cave. And we would send notes to our mean parents, telling them that we would not come home until they agreed to buy us our own horses. And only imagine how envious our classmates would be when they learned we were living in a cave on a ranch. So, with the plot established, it was time for packing. We packed a suitcase full of all the things we would need, coloring books and crayons, and comic books to read while we waited for our parents to relent from the pain of missing their children. Plastic pop-apart beads that could become necklaces or bracelets to wear in case we were invited to dinner by our hostess. Some snacks in case we were not. All the essentials. There were so many essentials that by the time we were finished packing, we could barely lift the suitcase between us, let alone carry it. That didn't stop us, though. We got Diane's little brother's red wagon, snuck it into the house when we hoped Mom wasn't looking, and between the two of us managed to get the suitcase into it. Then it was out the door, down the front walk, and then a left turn onto the sidewalk. Mom came to the door at that point. I expect the wagon made a bit of noise in the house, and was immediately so concerned that she leaned on the door frame and called out, "Have fun! Be home in time for dinner." Well, I thought, she'll be sorry when we're not. As I recall, we made it about a block and a half before we ran out of steam and decided to take a rest. After sitting on the overstuffed suitcase in the sun for a while, we began to get awfully hot, and after a bit longer, that dinner sounded pretty good. I never did get that horse. This is Cowgirl Dreams by Kathy Bailey. This next story is entitled The Music Box. It was sure to impress her classmates. This was sent in by Barbara Cole. "We'll be getting off the school bus at 3:20, I informed my mother. "When you see the bus doors open, turn on the music box." My instructions continued to include making sure she understood about rotating the tiny crank on the round, flat bottom of the machine, which played only one classical tune. The previous night, I had rearranged our living room, placing the blue, silvery music box my favorite aunt, Aunt Rose, had given me, on a table behind our sofa. Next to the sofa was the oak library table, where I had sorted books on the end shelves, making sure no papers were sticking out from any of the volumes. Fluffy, our blonde, long-haired cat, wanted to stay outside, away from the fray. I was 7 years old. This was my first time to host a sleepover at my house. Everything had to be perfect, lest I lose standing among my Southern Ohio third-grade girl classmates. We lived in the country. All my friends, especially my closest pal, lived in the nearby town, somehow making them rate a higher social status in my eyes. The new furniture placement meant that when my friends and I arrived and I offered them seating on the sofa, they could hear the music playing in the background. They could see that we belonged to a home where people liked to read, even if, in truth, I was the only one who really cared much about books. They would see that we were not just country folk. Where at that age and time I got the idea of the need for background music, I have no clue. How I thought it appropriate to boss my mother in that manner, I can hardly imagine. Now I know how fortunate I was to have a mother who tolerated my imperial attitudes. I was a little control freak in the making. The music box might have produced tinny or hollow sounds to others, but to my ears it was music, beautiful music. Crumpled and yellowed, Felix Mendelssohn's sheet music sat on our ornate Victorian-age pump organ. No one but me ever coaxed a sound from it. Radio's Grand Ole Opry entertained us on Saturday evenings, coming on right after Zorro, my favorite show. Only the two of us, Mother and I, sometimes played Old Maid or dominoes or worked on a jigsaw puzzle. Mostly I retreated into my books, reading one of the 14 my mother had borrowed for me from the bookmobile. Right along beside my book stack was that pre-Muzak, pre-CD, pre-Pandora, Spotify, or Sirius item, my beloved music box. Years later, I learned that music boxes came in all sorts of fancy forms, some with carousels, others with two or more levels. Some supported snow globes. Mine, a simple one, had only a small design on the top metal cover. The slightly indented bowl above the instrument's enclosed revolving cylinder offered a perfect location for a little girl's first jewelry. I thought it was pretty special to have one, as I knew no other classmates who owned one. Well, I grew up and left home for college. My mother passed on, and our home was sold, and somewhere along the way, the music box disappeared. How I'd like to have it now, to wind it as my mother did that spring day, watching me and my friends hop off the bus. If I had it now, I'd make myself a steaming cup of chamomile, pretend I had a cat, listen to its gentle music, and yes, remember the good old days. This was The Music Box by Barbara Cole. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.